This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Steve Jolly. KPFT News can be heard weekdays at 5. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio. KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Hello and welcome to the October 8th, 2007 edition of Queer Voices. I'm Deborah Bell.
And this is Jennifer Renee.
And J.D. Doyle.
And Glenn Holt.
And that's the crew for tonight. For some reason, I thought we were going to be in Fun Drive, but we're not.
It doesn't mean they can't make pledges.
That's right.
They can make pledges tonight.
They can go online and make pledges at www.kpft.org. Right. God. I forget. You have to say the right, you know, extension.
Can't be net.
It's
got com.
It's got to be a way. There should be a word that stands for www. Mm. Or do you really even need to say that anymore?
With some browsers, you don't have to enter that even.
Yeah, and you don't have to enter the HTTP anymore.
No, you don't
slash
have to
slash. No,
you
slash
don't.
Slash. Oh, it's all crazy. I'm just learning something new every day about technology. Well. Even though we're not in Fun Drive and aren't going to be begging you for money, we'll do maybe do that next week.
Yeah, we have a fun show, though.
We have a very full show, including talking to Caitlin McIntyre, who is in charge of the Seven Straight Nights for Equal Rights project. And along with that is going to be some discussion about the coming out support group that's over at the Montrose Counseling Center. We'll have This Way Out, including news wrap. And J.D., what do you have on board?
Hey, about 9 o'clock, I'll be interviewing Charmin Petrie, who will tell us about the Houston Women's Festival, which is coming up on October 20th. And I've got a bunch of music to play from the artists who appear.
Oh, very exciting. Mm-hmm. And that's a big event every year, especially for the women's community. But you know what? This is a festival that men are welcome to come to.
Oh, absolutely.
And then, Jennifer, you have a big interview.
Yes. those of you who may have been living in a cave probably haven't heard about the Employment Non-Discrimination Act that last Thursday, we've been almost 20 years trying to get the same inclusive act through, and on last Thursday a week ago, so that's 11 days ago, Barney Frank entered a reduced one, a weaker bill, and there's been a controversy ever since in that HRC, at the time it came out, didn't come out against the new bill.
Wait a minute, the Human Rights Campaign
Yeah, you know the people where you write the checks to? Well, they didn't come out immediately. As a matter of fact,
are they thinking a diluted bill's better than no bill?
That's what they apparently. We're going to find out tonight because the executive director of HRC, Joel Solomonese, is going to be here, and I'm going to ask him a few questions just like that.
And that's along with Jeff Reed, our political beat reporter, and they're going to share that interview. So that should be very interesting. So really stay tuned for more of Queer Voices tonight. And JD, good to see you back in the studio.
Thank you.
We've missed you. And
he's back in the saddle again.
Thank you for not singing.
Is that a gay song?
Gay.
If it is, it'll be on J.D. Doyle's QueerMusicHeritage.com.
That's right. Is there one in there? Is there a song like that in your repertoire?
No.
Oh,
some
geez,
not
I'm
too
sorry.
Different.
Oh, and anyone listening, you may have heard that the interview with Joe Solomonese was at 8:30. It's going to be at 9:30 tonight.
Okay, so just keep listening till you hear it.
That's right. We have a programming change.
Okay, well, Caitlin, welcome to Queer hear voices. And first of all, I guess we just need to say, what the heck does Seven Straight Nights for Equal Rights mean?
Well, Seven Straight Nights for Equal Rights is a nationwide event. It's taking place all across the United States in 35 cities over 7 days. And it's basically just a series of overnight vigils led by straight allies. In an effort for straight allies to stand shoulder to shoulder with GLBT Americans and declare their solidarity and to declare that equality matters to all of us and everyone.
And is it because of National Coming Out Day on October 11th that it's being done at this time?
Yes, they chose National Coming Out Week, you know, kind of as a way to say, you know, we're coming out as allies. Coming out is important to everyone. We all need to declare our intention to be counted.
Mm-hmm. Well, Caitlin's a beautiful young woman. She's a student at Rice University. Her picture appears in Outsmart magazine this month. I think you should have been on the cover. But how did you get involved with this? Because you're not gay, you're not a lesbian, and you're not bisexual, and you're not transgendered. So you are, in fact, one of the straight allies.
Yes. Well, when I was in the fourth grade, my dad came out of the closet as a gay man. And I grew up in a very homophobic town. So all throughout elementary school and
welcome
high school.
Welcome to the world.
Yeah. I was forced to hide that part of myself, which is really important to me. And so when I got to college, I decided that I wasn't going to do that anymore. That wasn't okay with me. And so I came out as an ally, and I started to tell my story to everyone, and I started to decide that I need to be more proactive. So when I saw Seven Straight Nights for Equal Rights on the Soul Force website, I decided that's what I'm going to get involved in.
And mention what Soul Force is.
Soul Force is a nonprofit organization dedicated to nonviolent resistance for GLBT rights. It was actually founded by the Reverend Mel White, which used to be an advisor to Jerry Falwell.
Yeah. We've had Mel as a guest on the program before. And so in this town that you lived in where you had a gay dad, were you living with your dad?
No, I live with my mom, but I went to see my dad every other weekend, and, you know, he has a partner of 8 years. He's like a second father to me. So I did live with my mom, but so it was easier to keep it quiet. But that's always something I regretted, that I wasn't more open about it. So I'm trying to make up for some lost time.
Yeah. Well, it's really hard to be, especially when you're younger. Sometimes it's not safe to be.
Right.
That's just simply the reality. But how did you take it at that age? I mean, it was like, well, you couldn't have been happy that your parents were separating.
Right. It was harder for my sisters, who are older than me, actually, than it was for me. I was at the age where, you know, my dad was my dad, and, you know, the divorce was harder than the fact that he was gay for me. My family had always been really open to all sorts of different people, so I wasn't that horrified by it. I actually didn't realize it was that big a deal until I told somebody, and then they were like, what?
You were 8 at the time?
About 8, yeah.
Yeah, and so you knew what gay meant?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
One time I was riding in the car going to a meeting with one of my sons with me, and he was about 4, and I said, oh, there's Gail and Michelle. They were in the car in front of us, and they were pulling in where we were going. He says, yes, they're gay. I said, what does gay mean? Because I'm like freaking out that he even says it. And he says, it means that they love each other.
Mm.
Of course, I just thought that was the cutest thing, right? So, I guess coming to Rice is what brought you to Houston?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. And you're in what year?
I'm a sophomore.
A sophomore,
yes.
All right. So, are you active on campus with any of the student groups?
I'm part of Queers and Allies. It's more recent. I didn't really get involved with it last year, but this year I'm getting involved. We're trying to do some community service activities, so hopefully we'll start to get a little louder on campus, because Rice is known for being somewhat apathetic, unfortunately. So,
but there are groups there. There's some wonderful professors.
There's an Ally program, and which is really wonderful. I went to Ally Training as on the panel for Ally Training, and it's just really great to see people learning about it and how homophobia hurts everyone. And we try our best to be diverse.
Mm-hmm. Among your age group, which I guess is the early 20s,
I'm 18.
Oh, you're a sophomore at Rice and you're 18?
Yes.
Okay. We're talking about beautiful and smart. Okay. Well, so, okay, 18 to early 20 years. What do you find in that age population? Do you think the younger generation is more understanding, accepting, tolerant?
I think they definitely are a lot more accepting. You know, it's a lot of where you're raised, but I think that our generation is more willing to learn. We're less set in our ways, even if we have preconceived notions and preconceived prejudices. When we meet people and we experience it, we're more likely to be able to accept it. At Rice, among my peers, I've had very few negative experiences, and those that I have had, when once you say to them, you know, that's not really okay to say, that's not really true, and you teach them, I think that they're very responsive. So I have a lot of hope that, you know, we're at the beginning of something, that we can make a lot of change, and that we can be the generation to help it along.
That's wonderful. So, what are some of the basics for the Houston event? How can people find out more about it, and how can they take part in it?
Okay, well, there's a website, 7straightnights.org.
Is that the number 7 or the word 7?
7 spelled out. So SEVEN, straightnights.org. And that has the stories of all the state leaders and why they decided to get involved, and also has vigil info. So you can go on there and get the address, the times. It's going to be at the Montrose Counseling Center on 401 Brannard Street. They've graciously offered to let us use their location. It's on October 11th, starting at 6 p.m. And from 6 to 10, it's going to be basically the time when we have like a meeting, everyone, and we're going to have a letter writing campaign out. So people can like have hands-on involvement. At 7, we're watching a really great movie called In-Laws and Outlaws, which is straight people and gay people telling their stories about love. And then we're going to hear from people telling their stories about allies, about coming out as LGBT, about their experiences. And then we're going to start the candlelight vigil at 10, and that will conclude at 7 a.m. So.
Now, is the whole event outdoors?
It is. It's out in the outdoor portion of the Montrose Counseling Center. There's this covered area in case it rains. So
yeah.
Rain or shine.
Yeah, this week seems to be one of those very iffy ones.
Yeah.
And what other activities are planned for the night?
Basically this year, we're trying to make it an annual event. So this year I'm just trying to get some interest behind 7 Straight Nights. I'm trying to get allies to realize that they can get involved. They don't have to be afraid to make an impact. And so this year I'm really focusing mostly on the participants. So basically, it's going to be a chance for everyone who's there to tell their own stories, to give their own personal ideas. And also, letter writing is a really great way to get involved. That's how I started. I joined a few, you know, online organizations.
So you're going to do letter writing at the...
Yes.
That evening. And mm-hmm. What kind of letter writing? You're going to come out to people? You're going to...
No, we're
going
to write to legislators about the different issues affecting us right now. You know, gay marriage, the Matthew Shepard Act, which is in danger of being vetoed. Transgender inclusive ENDA, all sorts of things, just to make our voices be heard. Because
so, do people need to bring stationery and pens?
No, everything will be provided. If they want, they can bring like blankets or chairs to watch the movie if they're coming. I will have some, but maybe not enough for everybody, depending on how people show up. So, if they want somewhere comfortable to sit, they can.
So
bring
they
that.
Can bring their bug spray,
their
comfy pillow,
yep.
And some popcorn. Are there going to be refreshments? Or?
We're going to have popcorn. I'm going to try to get some cooler. And coffee. It'll be basic because it is a nonprofit event, but I'm still working on trying to get some donations. So
it's pretty laid back and a good opportunity to talk with some other folks and to be visible.
Yes.
And which is kind of the point of Coming Out Day.
Right.
Coming Out Day was started in 1988, was the first one, which it followed on the October 11th, 1987 March on Washington for GLB. LGBT rights, which was also the first showing of the names quilt.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody said, well, you know, if everybody came out, the world would just get over it. And so it was like urging everyone. And some people go, oh, but I'm so out. You know, what else can I do? So the theme of Coming Out Day is to take your next step.
Right. I think it's really important, too, for allies. I think a lot of times people are allies with their convictions, but they don't do anything about it. And it's one thing to know that it's wrong, and it's another thing to do something. And it's really important that we take the steps to do something, because our opponents definitely are. They're calling their representatives every day. They're writing letters. They're making phone calls. And we need to be visible as well.
So if people want... Do they need to sign up?
They don't need to sign up. No, they can just show up
but
however long. There's a sign up at mysignup.com/7 SN Houston. And you can sign up for a shift then so that I know I'll have someone at all times. Not a lot of people are really utilizing that, but if you'd like to, you can. But otherwise, just show up anytime for however long you can.
Okay, and again, give the time, the date, the place.
Okay, it's at Montrose Counseling Center, which is on 401 Brannard Street. And it is on October 11th from 6 p.m. to 7 a.m. with a 7 p.m. movie.
So people don't necessarily have to stay all night.
No.
But it's kind of a in the spirit to...
Right.
To
some of us are giving up our whole nights just to show our commitment to GLBT rights. But you by no means have to. I understand it's a weeknight. People have work. I'm just encouraging people to come out, you know, for 15 minutes even, if you have any time, just, you know, to be counted, you know, maybe fill out a couple letter-writing campaigns just to say, you know, I'm an ally and I'm proud. And it's not just for allies. I don't want that to be the conception. I want everyone to come so we can all stand together.
That's the idea. It's
yes.
All standing together, and we're all stronger for it. And like you said, you hope that this will be an annual event that
yes.
that goes on, maybe some expanded activities.
Yep.
Caitlin McIntyre with Seven Straight Nights for Equal Rights has been our guest on Queer Voices. That's at the Montrose Counseling Center on October 11th, starting at 6 p.m.
Yep.
Thanks for being with us on Queer Voices.
Thank you so much.
Good times are old. Now we're growing and growing.
This is J.D. Doyle, and for this next segment coming up, we needed a great coming out song, and that one certainly qualifies. From 1997, Zrazy and Come Out Everybody.
This is Queer Voices.
Love that song. And, of course, that group has been at the Houston Women's Music Festival, and J.D. will be talking to the producers of that a little bit later in the program. But now we're going to talk a little bit more about coming out. And it is one of the biggest steps that a GLBT person or their family or their friends take sometimes. So we have Chris Kerr, who's a program coordinator at the Montrose Counseling Center, and Troy Grimmel, who is a practical intern, which means that he is trying to study and work hard to be a therapist in his own right, LPC. LPC to start with. But you know, you're just going to have to go more. You get the PhD and everything. And the Montrose Counseling Center is good training ground, especially for someone who is GLBT to train if they're going to be a therapist. There's so many activities over there and a number of different types of support groups and programs. Chris, tell us about the coming out support group. I know we've had Sally Huffer on before talking about that group. So it's a group that takes up again every so often?
Yes. It's in keeping with the mission of the Montrose Counseling Center to offer the community affordable, affirming, and quality mental health services. And so we're offering a coming out support group that's free, no charge. We offer it either two or three times each year, and so we're getting ready to start this coming Friday. And we're trying something new this fall by doing it on a Friday night, hoping that we can get more people interested and that people can start the weekend outright by coming to a support group from 6:30 to 8, and then you can go off to do the rest of your weekend after that, after you've kind of got yourself oriented and got your focus on coming out. So coming out's not an easy process. For many people, coming out is very scary, and that can be for any age. You can be 18, you can be 30, or you can be 50 or 60, and still right in the beginning of the coming out process.
Yes, I have a friend who, in fact, was in her, well, she's like my age. She was like 57 when she first came out.
Yes.
I thought I was a late bloomer because I was in my early 30s and had been married and had children and all that. So we come to this coming out, which define what coming out is.
Well, a simple definition. In fact, I picked up this pamphlet from the Human Rights Campaign Coming Out Project, and they define coming out as the process in which a person first acknowledges, accepts, and appreciates his or her sexual orientation or gender identity and begins to share that with others. So it's
so
saying,
first number one is coming out to number one.
You have to admit that I am gay, I'm lesbian, I'm bisexual, or I'm transgender, and sometimes for some people that's a very scary admission. For other people, it's like the light bulb goes on, and at last, this explains what I've been going through.
Suddenly, life makes sense.
Yes. And for some people, it's, what do I do to change this? And other people, it's, well, if I'm gay or lesbian, what do I do to live it out and express it? But, and as you said, people come out at different ages, and for some people, it's been that they knew all along, but they have repressed, hidden, tried to change. We're told, gee, if you get married or join the military, it'll change. It's just a phase. And for other people, even, like you said, at 57, it can be actually a surprise that now life makes sense. I never understood this and I didn't think I was gay, but boy, this certainly makes sense and this is the way it ought to be. And now I hear the violins when I kiss somebody, so that must be mean I'm gay.
Well, you know, some people are on the spectrum of sexuality as well. So I've had lesbians tell me they didn't like sex with men, and I'm like, well, you can, you know, you can like sex with men, and you can like sex with women. And so for some people, I just think there is a level of preference that can come to it. And then there are, of course, bisexual people who very often don't have to come out because they still often have the option of heterosexual privilege.
Sure.
But by staying closeted as a bisexual.
Well, and we're always clear on that. That's one of the myths, that being your orientation, your sexual orientation, is not a choice. It's a given. It's something you discover. They may not know exactly how or where, but by the first time a person is aware of it, it's there. It's a given. And really, the only choice there is whether I'm going to accept it and embrace it, or whether I'm going to run from it and try to hide it. And that's where a lot of the pain and a lot of the courage and a lot of the help comes in becoming aware of this about myself, and what do I do now?
Mm-hmm. And Troy, what is your role in all of this?
Well, I'm actually going to be facilitating the groups. We're going to meet for about 8 weeks. As Chris said, we're going to be starting this Friday evening at 6:30, and through the various weeks of meeting, hopefully with lots of individuals and families. You know, families are welcomed as well, to just discuss, you know, this sort of lifelong journey of coming out. It's not a one-time deal. It's something that we, you know, will continue to do. And, you know,
every new person you meet is an opportunity to come out.
That's right.
And certain situations are opportunities to come out or not. Do you talk about when not to come out?
That's covered, and it's really clear, and we try to make it very clear in this process that each person is in charge of their coming out process, and it's up to you to determine when, where, how, who, and part of the coming out support group is, of course, to help get support, because it's a lot easier if you can talk to other people going through the same thing, if you can get some accurate information, maybe get some of your own misperceptions or prejudices addressed. It's hard to come out if you are in the state of mind that what I am and trying to share with people is an abomination or a terrible thing, or it's going to kill my parents. So coming to a support group to help heal some of that and change some of that can be very helpful.
I think there is one documented case of when someone told their parents they were gay and their parents
they just
over.
Dropped it. Yep.
And then, of course, the comic Kate Clinton, when she said she was told that if don't tell Daddy, I'll kill him. And she was like, oh, really?
You suddenly have all that power.
Such power, yes.
Well, and the guest you had beforehand, I like that her involvement with Soul Force, because that's also, in a sense, of this political action support group to help people on a spiritual basis, because oftentimes that's where the beginning of that self-loathing and what we call internalized homophobia starts, is from a kind of a spiritual perspective when people are told you're an abomination.
Yeah, and she's coming out as a straight ally, and so that's another aspect. You said families were welcome, so who are the people that could or should, although we always say there's no shoulds and coulds, that should attend this group? Who is it?
Yeah, I'm fond of not shooting on anything. But you know, I think the more and more people are comfortable expressing their sexuality in a public forum, I think it's pretty common that we all might know someone who is. And I would think that particularly parents, siblings of a gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered individual might benefit from some of the information that we're going to be presenting in these I like to think of them more as workshops.
But it's also clear, though, that the main people who should be coming to this group would be people who are themselves beginning the coming out process, or thinking about maybe beginning the coming out process, or who have been thinking about it for a while and are feeling stuck, or just want some help, some support, some nudging along the way, and that they need to know that this will be a safe place. And for some people, it may be the only guaranteed safe place that they're willing to try in the beginning.
And understand that what safe place means is that what is said there in that room stays in that room, unless you choose to discuss your own personal story.
Right.
You're not supposed to talk about what anybody else said.
Yes.
Well, you can say this: someone said blah, 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 but you don't identify that person. You
right.
respect the confidentiality.
It starts with that who is there and what they say is confidential. You don't share that. But also it's safe in the sense that you have a guaranteed place where people will accept you for who you are. And people will not judge you. People will not put any kind of moral judgment. It's we accept you for who you are, and you're going to be sitting with other people who are accepting you for who you are, and probably in the process or in the journey themselves,
right,
maybe just as fearful about being outed as you are. So, of course, that's, I'm not going to out you, and you don't out me. We're going to do this together at our own level.
You can out me. It's okay, yeah. Chris.
Because it's Michelangelo Signorelli wrote a book, Outing Yourself, and he made a thing. It sounds simple, but I never thought of it. The easiest people to come out to in the beginning is gay or lesbian strangers.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think of that, you know, coming out to your parents, your friends, your family, that's very scary.
The more intimate, the harder it is.
Coming out to people you've known all your life, gay or straight, that can be kind of scary. But if, when you walk into a group of people you've never met before, but you know that they themselves are also gay or lesbian and they will accept you, that's the easiest and beginning step.
This is Deborah Bell, and we're talking with Chris Kerr and Troy Gimmel from the Montrose Counseling Center, and they're talking about the coming out support group. We have roughly 2 minutes, so what all do we need to let them know in those?
Well, just to repeat that it's Friday, October 12th.
Starting,
and it's going to be 8 weeks, and they can even talk about extending that for a few more weeks if they feel they need it. Starts at 6:30, goes 6:30 to 8. It's at the Montrose Counseling Center, which is at 401 Brainerd or Bernard. Bernard is a street that runs parallel, and it's between Richmond and Alabama on the second floor. The phone number for more information or to talk to anybody there is 713-529-0037. Anybody, any age can attend this. You don't have to be a counseling client. You can just walk off the streets, be there Friday, and you'll meet Troy and you'll meet the other participants there, and you'll start a journey.
Do people have to call to sign up, or they can just come in?
It would be nice if we could maybe get some sort of head count, but not necessary. They can actually leave me a voicemail message. My extension there is 701, and that would be for Troy Grimion. And the other thing I just want to say before we go off is, you know, 20 years this month is 1987 when the coming out started.
Yeah.
Think about that.
Yeah.
With the quilt, the AIDS quilt.
I was there, so I'm
in
thinking.
In D.C.
And they talk about different topics along the way. So there is, you know, coming out to your family, spirituality, dealing with internalized homophobia and self-loathing, kind of getting in touch with your history and pride, coming out in the workplace. But as each person comes, all they'll be challenged to do is to be comfortable and then talk about what progress would you like to make and how can we help you with that.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, because identity is sort of moving toward that internal sense of congruence. And I think that's all the journey that we're all on.
And we love those websites, so give us the website address.
It's and then it's all one word, montrosecounselingcenter.org.
Thank you for being with us on Queer Voices.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Rick Watts.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending October 6th, 2007. Colombia's Constitutional Court this week ruled that same-gender couples were entitled to the same social security rights as their heterosexual counterparts, and that gays and lesbians should be able to include their partners in their health insurance plans. A bill granting those benefits was initially passed by Colombia's Congress in June, but ultimately defeated when a small group of senators, reportedly under pressure from the South American country's powerful Roman Catholic Church, used a procedural maneuver to reverse their votes on the measure. Although homosexual acts were decriminalized in the 1980s, LGBT activists there now say that at least in the near future, they'll need to depend on the courts to secure further rights for same-gender couples.
In what is likely the strongest example yet of how the Internet has changed U.S. political discourse, a battle has been waging, mostly online, over the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA. While trans people were added in recent years, lesbi-gay activists have lobbied for a federal bill banning workplace discrimination against gays and lesbians for more than three decades. In its original incarnation in the current congressional session, ENDA would ban discrimination in employment based on sexual orientation and gender identity or expression. But claiming that there weren't enough votes to pass a transgender-inclusive bill in the Democrat-controlled Congress, lead sponsor Barney Frank of Massachusetts, who's been reelected to his seat several times after coming out as a gay man, offered an amended version last week that eliminated the gender identity or expression provisions. The other lead sponsor, openly lesbian Representative Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, then asked that her name be removed from the amended bill.
An online war of words also began between Frank and Lambda Legal, one of the country's leading LGBT legal advocates, and an unprecedented coalition of queer groups around the country over the removal of transgender protections and the language of the revised measure. While acknowledging Frank's long-term advocacy on behalf of the LGBT community, opponents of the stripped-down version of ENDA charged that there were loopholes that could still allow employers to fire or refuse to hire lesbians or gay men if they didn't conform to the standard definitions of femininity or masculinity. And while exemptions for religious institutions remained, they also claimed that faith-based businesses, such as church-run hospitals, would still be allowed to fire or refuse to hire gays and lesbians.
More than 150 organizations across the U.S., led by the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, and including such groups as the National Center for Lesbian Rights, the American Civil Liberties Union, People for the American Way, Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, numerous statewide LGBT groups, and virtually all transgender rights organizations, have historically united to say that no person in the LGBT community should be abandoned in the fight for employment rights. The country's largest queer advocacy group, the Human Rights Campaign, which joined the discussion a bit later, has issued its own press releases opposing an ENDA that doesn't include the trans community. In a statement released on October 1st, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California wrote that, after discussions with congressional leaders and organizations supporting passage of ENDA, we have agreed to schedule markup of the bill in the Committee on Education and Labor later this month, followed by a vote in the full House. This schedule will allow proponents of the legislation to continue their discussion with members in the interest of passing the broadest possible bill.
House Majority Whip James E. Clyburn of South Carolina issued a statement on October 5th, erroneously calling it the Employee Non-Discrimination Act, but confirming Frank's assertion that, despite the leadership's strong desire to pass an inclusive measure, the whip count made clear that we simply lack the necessary votes to pass a gender identity inclusive version of the bill at this time. That reluctance, however, doesn't seem to reflect the views of the heterosexual public. In a September poll conducted online by Harris Interactive in conjunction with Witek Combs for Out and Equal, a San Francisco-based U.S. LGBT group that advocates for equitable workplaces, a majority who self-identified as heterosexual incorrectly believed that job protections for gays and lesbians already exist in federal law. 79% said that how an employee does his or her job and not their sexual orientation should be the standard for judging an employee. 67% also said the same thing about gender identity.
In other news, Grace Abrams and Fiona Power have become the first legally recognized same-gender couple in Australia. The federal government was forced to formally acknowledge the marriage last week, following a decision by the country's Administrative Appeals Tribunal to grant a female passport to Abrams, a post-operative trans woman. She had married her long-term female partner using her male birth certificate before undergoing gender reassignment surgery in Thailand in 2005. Abrams was then denied a passport, reflecting her new gender when she returned to Australia on the grounds that she was married to a woman. She successfully appealed that decision by Foreign Affairs Minister Alexander Downer at the tribunal in Sydney last month. Prime Minister John Howard's government has consistently opposed any legal recognition of same-gender couples and has announced that no actions favoring such rights would even be considered until after the next elections.
Elsewhere, prison authorities in Saudi Arabia this week began administering 7,000 lashes to each of two men convicted of committing homosexual acts, according to a report on the 365gay.com website, citing the local Okaz newspaper. The two unnamed men were dragged into a public square in the southwestern city of Al-Baha, where their shirts were removed and they were whipped. The process was repeated the next day, according to the report, and was to have continued until all 7,000 lashes had been administered. Islamic law, as interpreted and enforced in Saudi Arabia, allows sentences ranging from imprisonment and flogging to death for deviant sexual behavior. In the past several years, there have been a number of reported mass arrests at what authorities have called gay weddings in various parts of the country, but little official information has been released on the outcomes of any trials or punishments carried out for those convicted.
But two gay men targeted by anti-gay death squads in Iraq were granted asylum in the United Kingdom in late September. One had worked as a cultural programs officer for the British Council in Baghdad, and the other was a doctor at Baghdad's Al-Numan General Hospital. Both had received death threats from fundamentalist militias, and a grenade had been thrown through a window at the home of one of them. His partner was kidnapped, tortured, and murdered in April 2004 by men suspected of belonging to the Badr militia, according to the London-based organization Iraqi LGBT. The group says that since the U.S. invasion of Iraq, militant death squads have executed hundreds of people solely for being gay.
A Minnesota judge this week refused to overturn the misdemeanor disorderly conduct plea and conviction of conservative U.S. Republican Senator Larry Craig of Idaho, arising from his arrest in a restroom sex sting operation at the Minneapolis airport. Craig emphatically denied being gay following those revelations and has consistently voted against LGBT interests in the Senate. Despite previous vows to resign on September 30th and then again if he wasn't allowed to withdraw his guilty plea, Craig announced this week that he now intends to finish his term in office. "I have seen that it is possible for me to work here effectively," he said in a statement. But Craig also said he wouldn't seek a fourth term in November 2008. Most observers believe that seat is nevertheless likely to stay Republican.
And finally, actor George Takei, best known for his role as Hikaru Sulu in the original Star Trek TV series, has become the first openly queer person to have an asteroid named after him. The asteroid, formerly known as 1994 GT9, located between Mars and Jupiter, has been renamed 7307 Takei by the International Astronomical Union. Unlike several websites that offer to sell naming rights to stars, the IAU-approved names are actually used by astronomers, according to Tom Burbine, the Mount Holyoke College astronomy professor, who proposed the new name. He said he suggested Takei in part out of appreciation for the actor's work with the Japanese American Citizens League, where he was cultural affairs chairperson, and with the Human Rights Campaign, for whom he's a spokesperson for its coming out project. Coincidentally, the 20th annual National Coming Out Day, which encourages LGBT people to take your next step in the coming out process, is observed yearly on October 11th. Takei joined Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry and fellow cast member Nichelle Nichols, who played Lieutenant Uhura, to have an asteroid named after him. The 70-year-old actor, who's most recently appeared on the immensely popular Heroes TV series as Hiro Nakamura's father, said he was blown away by the honor. "It came out of the clear blue sky, just like an asteroid," he said, adding, "I am now a heavenly body."
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 6th, 2007. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Rick Watts.
We'll hear about the creative politics of some Spanish activists and sample the political creativity of three musical artists later in the program. But first, growing up poor and gay gave Dan Matthews a wicked sense of humor, a soft spot for the underdog, and a nose for controversy. Perfect preparation for his role as vice president and campaign chief with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA. This year, Out Magazine included him on its 2007 list of the 50 most powerful gay men and women in America. So, who is this guy? For an enlightening bull session with Matthews, make that an enlightening bean session, we're delighted to welcome back This Way Out's Steve Pride after an extended medical leave.
Love it or hate it, mentioning PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, is unavoidable when talking about animal rights. And that's largely due to the efforts of Dan Matthews, the 6'5", former fashion model, whose first job was flipping burgers at his dad's restaurant, joined PETA in 1985, answering their phones, and today is senior vice president and director of their controversial publicity campaigns. Matthews talks about his life as an out gay man and animal activist in his new book, Committed, a rabble-rouser's memoir.
It is about how a reluctant party boy ended up devoting his life to a cause. It's a memoir, but it's done in about 15 standalone chapters, each with its own set of freaks, people that I've encountered in my life. I've always looked at life as a big black comedy, and I always wrote really just for myself to make sense of it. And over the years, I would do articles for different magazines as a way to help make ends meet beyond my meager PETA salary. And one thing after the other has sort of led to doing a book. It was not something I set out to do, but it's been very, very exciting. It's even coming out in Australia now.
And what does he think will surprise the reader most about his book?
Well, I think PETA's humor is evident in some of our campaigns, but not overall. And I think humor isn't really very present in most pressure groups. And to me, it's always been essential. I mean, I think a lot of people burn out with causes, whether it's gay causes or animal causes or any cause, if they don't lighten up a little bit. All the information can be such an overload. It can be so dire. And a lot of people become morose because of it. I've always sought to organize campaigns that are much more exuberant and fun. Things like the Rather Go Naked Than Wear a Fur campaign. Things like the Fur is a Drag campaign, which has involved everyone from Lady Bunny and Boy George to Katie Lang actually dressing as a girl. And I've always thought that campaigns should be fun because the whole point is to try to attract more people, not just their support, but to make them feel like they should learn more about an issue because the information about animal cruelty is just so overwhelming. I mean, there's, you know, issues like animals being blinded and scalded in laboratories and electrocuted and drowned on fur farms. And it's just that outrage is why I got involved in animal rights. But to try to attract other people, I think it's best to be fun.
Although he never ran with scissors, the chapters in which Dan talks about his childhood rival Augustine Burroughs for sheer hilarity.
You know, I grew up really in a white trash area and, you know, started looking after animals at a very young age. But I had a mother who was an orphan, and she never really had any guidance about what was right or wrong in life. So she just sort of made things up as she went along. And, of course, her instincts are, you know, a lot more progressive than most people's. She always urged me and my brothers to consider being gay. She thought there was something extra special about that. And it's odd that I'm the only one who actually became gay or only one who was gay. It's certainly a definitive argument about whether it's environmental or not. It's not. It's just who you are. Like if your eyes are brown or blue.
And the seed that grew into the empathy that defines Dan's adult life was planted in that childhood.
To me, it just seemed like cruelty was cruelty. And the kind of people who are cruel were the same guys who used to beat me up for being gay. And so I always saw from a very young age that animals needed help. They needed somebody to interfere on their behalf.
It's easy to forget that back in the day, this was not a cool cause.
When I first got involved in animal rights in the late 70s, it was something associated with Doris Day or Betty White. It was like a granny cause. So it was really odd. The first few protests I went to, it was me and a few of my punk rock friends and a bunch of grannies. It was like Lawrence Welk meets the Sex Pistols on the streets. And there was no media to speak of, really, at these early things. So, you know, being from the pop culture MTV generation, I always really could recognize the value in getting more artists involved and getting celebrities involved to help attract attention so that it wouldn't just be thought of as some kooky old lady cause. And so, yeah, making it sexy, making it funny, you know, like coming up with the whole Rather Go Naked Than Wear a Fur campaign, which is what really put PETA on the map all around the world. And the sort of things that inspired me to do that are all in the book. And so it's been exciting.
Matthews believes that animal rights is a cause especially relevant to our community.
Well, there's always been a huge crossover with gays and lesbians and animal rights. First off, our spokespeople have included people like everybody from Boy George and Melissa Etheridge to Lady Bunny and Morrissey and bands like Erasure, Sandra Bernhard, Martina Navratilova remains one of our biggest spokespeople. I think it's because gays grow up in a world where they know a lot of people look down at them or consider their suffering or their plight irrelevant. And I think a lot of people act like that about animals. They think it's just an animal. Who cares if they're suffering? My suffering's more important. And I think when people hear that attitude about animals, especially gays, it hits home with them because they realize that, you know, these animals have lives that are, they just want to survive. They just want to get by. They have good times, they have bad times, and they don't need these people basically ruining their lives, taking away their nature, and being so disrespectful about it, about their lives. And so I think that's one of the reasons why
you know, gays often feel like outsiders, and animals are sort of the ultimate outsiders.
Besides promising not to wear a coat made of Dalmatian puppies, what can an individual do?
I think the most important things people can do is to learn more about the issue. We have a really great website, PETA.org, which documents not only a lot of our crazy campaigns, but a lot of the real issues behind them, and to educate yourself. You know, we believe in freedom of choice. You should be able to eat what you want and wear what you want. It should just be an educated choice. And I think learning about these issues and being open to the idea of becoming a vegetarian or looking for alternatives to leather, which do exist, and to realize that you can have a great life without killing. If anybody wants to check out my MySpace page, there's a few sample chapters there, Dan Matthews with just one T, and you can read a little bit more about it. There's whole chapters on thrift shopping and things like that that are a bit of a diversion for it. So hope you check it out. It's in libraries if you want to check it out from libraries, or even steal it. I don't care.
This has been a conversation with Dan Matthews, Senior Vice President of PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and the author of Committed, a Rabble Rouser's Memoir. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
And if you just stop and think of it, there's no doubt of it, we would win a place in history.
If I could walk with the animals, talk with the animals,
grunt and screech and squat with the animals.
Enough. Save the Bulls, Olay, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Every July in the Spanish town of Pamplona, thousands celebrate the running of the bulls and its ensuing bullfights, during which bulls are tormented and slaughtered. To protest the cruel spectacle, animal rights activists have formed their own event called the Running of the Nudes. PETA member John Carmody, a gay Irishman, has participated in the event, during which over 1,000 people run through the same course as the bull run, wearing only red scarves and plastic bullhorns. Carmody called on compassionate members of the GLBT community to join him in the July event, a few days before the bull run. Many hope that the event will eventually replace its savage counterpart because, as Carmody says, quote, tormenting and butchering animals for entertainment is something straight out of the Dark Ages. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Garth Ellis.
Hi, this is Dan Matthews, author of Committed, a Rabble Rouser's Memoir, and Senior Vice President of PETA. And you're listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine.
Queer International, contempo alternative, and accessible jazz mix it up in the latest edition of The Audiophile.
En el medio de un pulso, en una noche sin sueño, cuando la luna brilla, en el medio de mi cama, aquello que dijiste, baila alrededor de que te muerto, baila alrededor de que te muerto.
That song is by Sonia and Disappear Fear, and the title in English is In the Middle of the Beat. Hi, I'm J.D. Doyle.
I'm Chris Wilson, and you're listening to Audiophile. Sonia and Disappear Fear have been releasing albums for 20 years now, and this time around in the album Tango, they go international.
Tango is my dance with the world. I've written songs in four languages, Hebrew, Arabic, Spanish, and English, and I hope that fans I have all across the borders everywhere know how much I love them, and I love the opportunity of my life to make this music. The world is ready to disappear fear, so here we go.
No sé si estoy chucha a ti, pero se siente como cayendo en el amor. No sé si estoy por allá. No sé si estoy chucha a ti, pero se siente como cayendo en el amor.
Find out more about Tango, the new album by Sonia and Disappear Fear, at www.disappearfear.com.
So you see, this is home. This is where I decide. This is why it's strange to have you seek for what I hide. I never built a door in my wall. I didn't alter the plans. But you didn't have to climb to put your hand inside my hand. Everyone else does.
The latest CD by Sacramento artist Phil Putnam is called Best of Intentions, and his music has been described as a piano-based blend of contemporary and alternative. He usually tells people it's like Billy Joel and Coldplay had a kid.
Well, Best of Intentions is definitely my most sophisticated record so far, both in the writing and also in the production. It really deals a lot with coming out, with claiming your sense of worth. And all the songs relate back to perfectionism and my idea that it's just a big waste of time. And it's really about claiming your flaws as the greatest part of our beauty.
We'll find a home all these days are not how we dream they would be. Those we love are not who we thought we would see. No one here can remember the name of his hometown or where he came from. There's not much here, so we can give it up and run.
You can get more information about Phil Putnam and his album Best of Intentions at www.philputnam.com. That's www.philputnam.com.
Transgendered artists we recently featured on Audiophile are in the early stages of their careers. On the other hand, Jennifer Lydham is a virtuoso on the upright bass who has appeared on over 100 recordings over the last 20 plus years with some of the giants of jazz music, both under her former name, John Lydham, and her new one after transitioning 6 years ago.
Well, The Real Me is my sixth CD. It's the first one to bear my true identity, Jennifer Lydham. And I'm very proud of it. It's all original music, but it's mostly accessible jazz. It's jazz that people that like rock or classical or folk music, they all seem to like this record. And again, I'm very proud of it.
And for the first time on this album, Jennifer added a couple of vocals.
Remember when the sounds you heard were crisp and clear? The melody and harmony were soothing to hear. But nowadays music seems designed to give you only fear. We'll stick it in your ear. The times have changed and romance is a thing of the past. Cro-Magnon ways and dog-eat-dog will fade to the last. I wish there was a way to keep from crying in your beard. We'll stick it in your ear.
Find out more about Jennifer Lydham and her album, The Real Me, at www.jenniferlydham.com. That's www.jenniferlydham.com.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can write to us at Post Office Box 66648, Houston, Texas 77006, or by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's
That's www.audiofile.org.
Audiophile is produced by Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trentum. I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm J.D. Doyle. Keep listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, John Beaupre, Rick Watts, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, Steve Pride, Judd Proctor, and Brian Burns with Garth Ellis, and Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trentum contributed program material, Roger Williams, The Chipmunks, Sonia and Disappear Fear, Phil Putnam, and Jennifer Lightham performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Listen online to This Way Out anytime and exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also get there by clicking on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Most This Way Out operating expenses are supported by direct, tax-deductible donations from you, our listeners, and we thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air. We'll thank you with your choice of some very special program CDs. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our weekly programs there. To request a CD or cassette copy of this week's program or sign up for our weekly email program information messages, email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We all thank you for listening. On 2ECR, Eden, New South Wales, WTIP, Grand Marais, Minnesota, KUR, Kutztown, Pennsylvania, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Yes, and coming up in this second hour, of course, J.D. will be with us in just a moment, but at 9:30, I'll be interviewing Joel Solmanese, the president of the Human Rights Campaign, and we're going to be discussing the Employment Non-Discrimination Act and the substitute that was introduced week before last.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way.
This is J.D. Doyle, and this is one of my favorite interviews of the whole year because we get to talk about the Houston Women's Festival coming up October 20th. There's a slew of wonderful artists that will be performing that day, and gee, I thought, how to get this across efficiently and effectively and quickly to the listeners? I put together a musical collage of 80 of the artists who will be performing. Starts off with Ruthie Foster, so please enjoy. We'll be back in a few moments.
Pretty women wonder where my secret lies. I'm not cute, I'm built to suit a fashion model size. When I start to tell them, they think I'm telling lies. I say it's in the reach of my arms instead of my.
Phenomenal woman,
pain. This is a joy, fall down again as I run through that springtime rain.
What if I stack the cards, hid the ace next to my heart, played out the game with a steady hand? What if I left the closet open, skeletons and all, invited in the press, leaving you to take the fall? What if I scratch below the surface enough to open up the bricks? Decades of desertion to erode it for a fix. What if I did all of the things that I swore I'd never do, just to get me off the hook and leave the blame with you?
Peter Pan was watching the pavement pass under him. His bugs are tickling his lips, dripping down his chin. I'm at the very back row of this ceiling, carpeted bus, and the fumes of the bathroom are pulling my gut. But we're doesn't know what I'm talking about. Who's never left home, who's never struck out to find a dream and a life of their own. Placing the clouds, the foundation of stone. Many precede and many will follow. A young girl's dream no longer hollow. It takes the shape of a place out west. But what if holds her? She has a guess. She needs wide open spaces, room to make her big mistakes. She needs new faces. She knows the high stakes. 16 years of age, but I sure wish I would have known. Just how easy life can change, but looking back now I can say that it's the best thing I've ever done wrong.
Doyle, and I've got Charmin Petre with me, And what's your title with the festival? Are you queen, king?
Well, I'm producer. Officially, but you know, there's a lot of people that go into making
the Empress of the festival.
Now that's a good one. I like that.
You just heard a 6.5-minute montage, collage, whatever you want to call it, of 8 of the artists featured at the festival. And I was getting into that just to give you for those keeping track. You heard Ruthie Foster. This is the order of the montage: Ginger Lee Band, Trina Hamlin, Amy Spies, Lindsay Mack, Susan Gibson, Paige Lewis, and Rockin' Out of There with Mary Cutrafello. You were saying a number of these artists are from Texas?
They are. It's amazing. We've got Mary Cutrafello, Paige Lewis, Ginger Lee, Susan Gibson, Callie Gray. All of those girls are from Texas.
Where does Ruthie Foster work out of these days?
She's Wimberley, Austin.
Well, that's Texas.
But she, you know, she travels so much. I guess she's a world of the world right now.
Okay. And I better start in what we're talking about. We're talking about the Houston Women's Festival. This is the 97th. Is that right?
Well, not quite. 13th.
13th annual
Women's That's a pretty
Festival.
Good number, though.
And it's October 20th. It's at Jones Plaza. Where's Jones Plaza?
Jones Plaza is 601 Louisiana at Texas. It's sandwiched between the Alley Theater and the Verizon Wireless Theater.
And it's a whole block, and it's set up for a festival. It's got ideal setup for that.
It does. It's got a big stage, and we're going to have a great sound crew out there, and a lot of refreshments, a lot of food, a lot of great music.
It starts what time?
Noon. And goes all the way till 10 p.m. Nonstop fun.
Where do people park?
There's a lot of theater parking, and
there's all those garages, right?
There's all those garages. Then there's, if you go to, if you just do a search for theatrical parking plus Houston, there's a map that tells you everything, but it's also on our website. And if it's not, I'll make sure it gets put on there.
Oh, you got a website?
Got a website.
Where might we find this?
www.hwfestival.org.
Charmin and I have been doing this for years, so we like know each other's questions and answers.
We also have a MySpace site, which is myspace.com/HoustonWomen'sFest.
So that website again was
www.hwfestival.org.
H for Houston, W for Women, festivals.org.
Very good.
And what is the history of this org?
Well, this is our 13th year. Shirley Knight actually founded it along with a few other of her friends 13 years ago, and it started out as just some of her friends that played music got together, and it became such a great hit. It started out with about 300 people, and it's grown by word of mouth, a little bit of publicity through Outsmart and KPFT, which, by the way, KPFT is one of our media sponsors, and we are very appreciative of that. But anyway, the festival's grown, you know, by word of mouth, basically, and community outlets like KPFT and Outsmart. And now, last year, we had 1,200 to 1,500. It's kind of hard to tell sometimes because some of the we also count in the volunteers and vendors that are there because all of those people enjoy the festival as well. But I'm expecting at least that many this year, about 1,200, 1,500, might even be 2,000.
And where does the so-called profits, are there profits? Where do they go?
There aren't profits. The so-called profits go right back in to the next year's festival so that we can bring bigger and better artists in. And, you know, as with anything, costs continue to rise. So, you know, we struggle with that sometimes, but we do put everything back into the festival.
What about the Athena Project? I saw that on your site.
The Athena Art Project, that's the umbrella that produces the festival, and it's a nonprofit organization, and its mission is to
Foster.
Foster. Thank you. You'd think I'd know. We are to empower and foster the artistic endeavors of women. Thank you for helping me with that, J.D. But yes, that's the umbrella, and actually, you know, we do empower and foster the artistic endeavors of women just by having this festival, because all the artists that play at our festival are independent artists, and unless they have a vehicle where they can play and be in front of a good audience, you know, they continue to struggle, and you know, we want them to be heard and want them to get a good fan base in Houston, and so I mean, we're helping out these artists that come to play at our festival.
And where can people get tickets?
Tickets are online at our website, www.hwfestival.org, and they are also available at several Houston area outlets. Lucia's Garden, which is on Portsmouth, DiCapo's Bakery on East 11th, at Studemont, and at the shop, Commonwealth at Westheimer.
And these names and addresses are on the website.
They absolutely are. If you just go to the website and click on tickets, all the information is there.
And we're not going to mention the price on it since it's a public station, but it's reasonable, especially when you consider the talent you're getting to see. And it's also an all-day party.
It really is. I mean, another thing about the festival is it's not just music. It's a way for people to get together, meet with old friends, meet new friends, and it's a really great community event that people come to year after year. I was at Decadent Desserts last night, and I ran into several people and said, "Are you coming to the festival?" And they said, "We would not miss it."
Here's a devil's advocate question. It's a women's festival. Are men welcome?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I know that because I've been going to this for years, and there are a lot of men every year.
Well, I guess that's a bit of a misnomer, but it's mainly because it's women-fronted bands, and we feature women artists, and so that's therefore the name Houston Women's Festival, and it is highly attended by women, but there are a good number of men that attend as well.
What's new this year?
What's new? Well, we've done a lot more publicity. We just felt the need to reach out to even more people, and so we decided to spend some of our funding on advertising dollars and through OutSmart and some other outlets such as that. But OutSmart has actually helped us out a lot. They, you know, have given us some breaks, and so it's very much appreciated. But yeah, that's one of the things that's new, and I guess another thing that's new is Ginger Lee, who was had a great performance last year and was just very well received by the audience. She's going to be the MC for the nighttime portion of the show, and Ginger's just a natural in front of the mic. She'll get people excited, pumped up, dancing, and just ready for a good show. And the other thing is, Ginger knows most of these artists, and so she has a personal. Yeah, she has a personal relationship with them, and can really, you know, talk them up and get people pumped up and ready to go.
It's got to be very difficult to decide who to invite every year. How do you do that?
You know, it is tough. I try to get a diverse lineup where there is not just one kind of music. I also try to get not just solo artists, but, you know, duos, trios. We've got actually a lot of trios and four-piece bands this year, and it's just a fuller sound. It's not that a solo act isn't good. It's just that the Jones Plaza is such a big arena that a solo act kind of gets lost up on that stage. Yeah. So, other thing is that you have to get these artists that are touring in your area or are willing to tour and make your this festival kind of an anchor.
What are their stops?
Date.
Yeah.
Because we cannot pay for their travel, so they've got to, you know, make it a tour stop along the way. So that's one of the things. Like, I've people probably know Erin McCowan or have heard
of
her.
Oh, I do, yes.
And she was unable to stop in Houston this year, and hopefully we'll have her in the future. But, you know, things like that, you know, I probably got turned down by three or four really good artists that I wanted to have here because I knew that there would be an audience for them, but it just didn't work out in
the schedule. There's always the logistics to work,
yeah,
to work on
it
too. What's there to do at the festival besides the music?
Well, we've got a lot of good refreshments. There's there's also a marketplace for vendors. There's a lot of arts, crafts, some informational booths that are information for things here in the community. I mean, Pride Festival will be there, you know. There's still, you know, a lot of people maybe that don't know about, you know, what's going on with the Pride.
Networking, socializing.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of socializing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of good music. I mean, that's what it is. Celebration of women and their, you know, artistic endeavors of women.
How many people does it take to put this event together?
It takes a lot.
A big village.
It is a big village. Oh, actually, we still need some volunteers. If anybody is interested, they can go to the website, and there's a volunteer section. It has an email address that you can contact. The one thing that we really need is TABC volunteers. If anybody out there is licensed, certified, we'd love if you would volunteer. I mean, we have some, but we could always use some more, because we want people to be safe and make sure they're responsible and so forth. So I'd like to have some of those people on board. But we can use volunteers in all areas. So just go to the website. There's a list of things.
The website is?
The website is www.hwfestival.org.
Okay.
What would I do without you, JD?
Well, we're going to recap, and then we're going to go out with a special song. I'll talk about that in a moment. It is what? It is the Houston Women's Festival. It is Saturday, October 20th from noon to 10 p.m. in Jones Plaza. So that's the what, the when, the where. The how has been done by all the volunteers. And closing the event, one of the artists I did not mention yet, she was not part of the medley at the beginning of the show because she does jazz, and it really is a different genre. It would not have done her music justice to put her in the medley with some of those rockers and soulful singers. You want to tell me who it is?
Kelly Gray.
People
are very excited that Kelly's coming. I've had a lot of comments about her.
She's a superb jazz artist, been doing this a lot of years. She's not performed here in a while, has she?
She has not. She's teaching in Austin, and that takes up a lot of her time. So she only does really special events, and, you know, this is one of them that I'm glad that she agreed to do.
Okay, we're going to close out with Kelly Gray, and that's track 9, Glenn. And the song is her version of Eleanor Rigby.
All the lonely people, where do they all belong?
writing the words of a sermon that no one will hear. No one comes near. Look at him working, donning his socks in the night when there's nobody there. What does he care?
This is Jennifer Renee. We have on the phone tonight the president of HRC, the Human Rights Campaign, Joe Solmanese. We're going to discuss tonight the goings on in Washington, D.C. about the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. Joe, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I certainly can, loud and clear. Also here in the studio is Jeff Reed, our local political pundit.
Hi, Joe.
Great. Hi, how are you?
Good. Joe, I guess we've all been around here. Anybody that's been listening and reading their blogs or reading their emails knows a bit about what happened or didn't happen Thursday a week ago. And I know there was a lot of misunderstanding and questioning concerning directly about HRC and what it was doing and all. So, what happened back on Thursday and Friday of week before last?
Well, what happened, which is something that often happens as a piece of legislation is about to go forward for a vote, is that oftentimes members of Congress who aren't paying attention to all of the details of the legislation begin to pay attention to it, their staff begin to pay attention to it, and the support or lack of support for some particular aspect of that legislation tends to really gel in the final days as members begin to pay attention. And as the Democratic leadership discovered on the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, they had run into some real problems in terms of the number of
Joe, this is Glenn, the board operator. Sorry to interrupt, but your phone line is breaking up, so we're going to have to disconnect and ask you to call us back. Can Can you do that right away?
Yeah, I'm
okay, thanks.
I'll be right.
Well, on that note, but I know that for all of you, I signaled Glenn in the control booth because it was breaking up. He's calling us right back, and we'll be back on the air. Okay, Joe, are you
sorry
there?
About that. Is this better?
Oh, much better. God, you were breaking up. It sounded like a cell phone in a bad area. So,
oh, I'm very
please
sorry
continue.
About that.
Please continue.
Okay, so at any rate, what the Democratic leadership in Congress discovered going into the final days before the markup of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act was that there was a real lack of support among members for the gender identity aspect of the bill. And just to be clear, the reason that began to become apparent is because our opponents were beginning to sort of show their show the strategy that they were going to use to try and derail the bill, and there is a procedure that our opponents use just before a vote on a bill called a motion to recommit, which is essentially a tactic to kill the legislation, and they generally will extract a piece of legislation out that what they perceive to be the weakest part of support of the legislation and ask for a stand on its own vote on that individual piece of the legislation. And if that fails, it essentially means it kills the entire bill. And so what we were hearing was that their intention was to pull out the gender identity aspect of ENDA, call for a vote on that, a vote that we would most likely have lost, and it would have then derailed the entire bill. So,
but Joe, why not just lose that vote? I mean, why not just take the high road and let them kill it?
Well, it really never even became a question of why not lose the vote or not, because Chairman Miller and others on the committee that the bill was to come out of decided that they were going. Their decision was to send the bill forward without gender identity.
But isn't HRC's job as the representative of the GLBT community to our elected officials in Washington, isn't your job to communicate to them the importance to our community of keeping the GLBT together in GLBT? And so, basically what you're telling us is you guys dropped the ball and you didn't keep the Democratic leadership apprised of the fact that this would be a huge affront to a very important part of the community. So
that is absolutely not what I said. That has nothing to do with what I said. What I said is that Congressman Frank and Chairman Miller made a decision that there was not support to at that point to pass a bill with inclusive language in it, and they decided to move a bill forward that was not inclusive. I didn't say if HRC had anything to do with that.
Well, let me ask a question then, because who wrote this substitute bill? Was it Barney Frank and Miller? Did they just sit down and how did that come about?
They made a decision to advance two bills, bills that were similar to the original bill that was in committee, but one that included gender identity and one that did not. But I want to be really clear. I want to be really clear that this is a very different time in Congress, and that Barney Frank, Chairman Miller, and others made a decision that they wanted to move this bill forward. And that is how we came to the place that we were in. HRC has always lobbied, as you well know, for inclusive legislation. We've lobbied at corporate America for inclusive policies, and the people who we had testifying during the congressional hearings on ENDA all were making the exact same case that we support inclusive legislation and that that's exactly what we've done in America's workplace. So what happened was that you had members of Congress making a decision whether HRC or any of the other GLBT groups, and you know there were a number of GLBT groups that were all doing the same thing, that regardless of what we would have them do, they moved this legislation forward and said this is what they wanted to bring to a vote.
So did they consult with you before they brought this to a vote? I mean, did you get a heads up about this, or did the vote just sort of blindside you and happen without any warning?
Well, I don't know how closely you've been following any of this debate, but there actually has not been any vote.
I guess what...
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to vote.
But when it came up on Thursday was the first I heard of it, when it hit every email I get as the transgender voice of Houston. Everybody wants to tell me everything that's going on, especially when it affects transgender.
Sure.
And suddenly I got heads up about it, and of course... Immediately at that point, 27 major organizations, national organizations, put out a letter that's still going on with over 500 attachments to it. But HRC was missing, and that was the concern of most people everywhere. What was going on at that time?
Well, I think what I'm getting from this conversation is there is a real lack of information out there that we have been working on overtime to try to get out to people, because, of course, there's been no vote, there's been no bill moved out of committee, nothing has happened on this legislation. The only thing that has happened is that immediately on Thursday or Friday of last week, a number of groups came out and said they adamantly opposed the bill. They would oppose any bill that went forward, and they would work to defeat any bill, whether it was inclusive or not. They would work to defeat any bill that went forward and went to a vote, and that they opposed any bill that went forward. On Thursday afternoon, the difference between HRC and every other organization is, of course, that we have a very in-depth congressional scorecard, and members are very interested and want to know and want to consult with us on how we're going to rate them. It's not unlike our corporate equality index, which I know you're familiar with.
Oh, absolutely.
We don't simply host the ratings of these companies and give them a score without consulting with them and talking about how they might be able to get to a better score. And so it's never been HRC's position to wake up in the morning and issue a press release and say, here's what we're doing, and then allow members of Congress an opportunity to read about it in a press release. That is what makes us different from any other groups. We have a very different relationship, and there's an expectation and a history and a relationship. So we spent Friday, Saturday, and Sunday over the course of the weekend trying to work through this, trying to see what we could do about keeping this from coming out of committee, talking with our congressional allies about what a difficult position this was going to put the community in, and what we heard around Monday afternoon was that regardless of what HRC or any of the other groups did, there was a decision that... members of Congress sort of liken this to the Family Medical Leave Act. And if you're familiar with the Family Medical Leave Act, it's something that never really, over the course of the 6 or 7 years that it was voted on, it was voted on 6 or 7 times.
Right.
It was about 6 different pieces of legislation. Each time it went forward for a vote, it was enhanced a little bit more. And, of course, it was during the first President Bush's tenure in office. So it was always a piece of legislation that was used as an educational tool. You get a member of Congress to vote on some of the aspects of it, you get them comfortable with it, you get them reelected, you bring it back the next year with more in it, and you get them to vote for more, and you get them comfortable, and you get them reelected. And that was really the response that the congressional leadership had around ENDA. And so we continued to say to them that we would not be able to support legislation that was not inclusive. And so we have, as you know well, a large board at HRC, and we consult with our board on these sorts of decisions. We had a board meeting last Monday night, so 3 or 4 days after other groups came out with their statements. Our board voted to reaffirm its 2004 position, which was that we could not support legislation that would not be inclusive. We are part of a coalition called the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, and we got, in conjunction with the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, a letter to the Hill on Monday afternoon asking that they delay releasing this bill out of committee at all, that they not release any bill out of committee.
Yeah, and I saw that they'd agreed to do that. And one of the things is, and so the full disclosure here, I'm co-chair of the Diversity Committee for the Houston Steering Committee. So I get all of HRC's emails. So I know I've been kept abreast of everything from the very beginning. So just to make that clear, one of the things is there that you're talking about that board board meeting that was there. And soon after that, or day after that, Donna Rose, the only transgender on the board, resigned. Now, what was the problem that she felt it necessary to resign?
Well, I mean, I certainly don't want to speak for Donna, but I think that Donna's preference would have been that previously, you know, the week before, that HRC immediately come out in opposition to the bill, as other groups did. You know, she certainly has, you know, she was part of the board meeting. We had a long conversation about how we should approach things. I know that there are a number of members of Congress who are completely supportive of inclusion, who have been very supportive of the trans community, and who said, you know, I'm going to do everything I can to make this bill be inclusive. But,
Tammy Baldwin, I think, is one of them.
Tammy Baldwin is one of them. You're absolutely right. But if the decision among the members is that they were going to first, you know, go forward with both bills, vote on a non-inclusive bill, 3 weeks after the bill passes, the plan is to have hearings on gender identity and then move forward with an inclusive bill and spend, you know, probably the course of the next year, get through the election, and then reintroduce an inclusive bill and try to get that passed. And it's, you know, it's a tactical debate in Congress. There are people who believe that once you get a member to vote on some bill and some aspect of a bill, they're never going to undo it. They're never going to unvote it, and you're never going to do the education piece on that aspect of the bill again. And, of course, in the end of the bill, there are huge corporate regulation, probably the most corporate regulation since the Family Medical Leave Act. There are the issues of you know, religious exemptions within the bill, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Oh, yes, very much so. I was going to ask about that, because that undermines even some advances that the GLBT community has gained over the last 20 years.
Well, let me just finish answering your question about Donna. At any rate, there's a point of view and there's a strategy on the Hill that is unfolding, that this ought to be, you know, not an incremental over many year process, but over, you know, maybe an 18-month to 2-year process, and that would be a more expeditious way of getting this bill passed. If you pull the bill now, which is another option, and you begin this whole process all over again, you know, in 2 years, sort of, you know, it wouldn't come up next year because, believe it or not, the congressional schedule, between, you know, for a variety of reasons, this probably wouldn't come up again until after the 08 election.
Oh, absolutely. And I understand that pushing it forward for many of the reasons that we've discussed. Again, it's still begs the question, this substitute bill has some language in it that Lambda Legal put out a letter, and of course there's been those letters going back and forth between Barney Frank and them, and of course I've got copies of all of that. The main thing is that the thrust, that there's some language in this substitute bill that is, you know, is very dangerous from as far as where I sit as a GLBT person.
Well, which aspects of the language are you talking about?
I think part of the big concern is the exemptions for religious organizations, which seems rather unprecedented in terms of trying to pass rights legislation. All of a sudden, all you have to do is claim some sort of religious exemption, and boom, you don't have to follow the law.
Well, I mean, you know, there has always been going to be a religious exemption in this legislation. I mean, we never were going to be able to move this forward without some religious exemption. This has gone through about a year's worth of negotiating with the Anti-Defamation League, with the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. And, you know, would we prefer that it be a narrower exemption? Yes. But again, this is the starting point of this bill, and yeah, I mean, the hate crimes bill, you know, is something that we've been working on for over 10 years, and you know, we obviously are feeling like we're very much at the end of that process. I think with this bill, we're at the very beginning. It's never been voted on in the House before, so I just want to be really clear that we have said we don't support the bill, but there are members of Congress who, Tammy Baldwin in particular, who also does not support the bill, but if and when this bill were to come to the floor for a vote, she would vote for it as a simply as a tactic to begin the education process with members, to get members on record, to get a better benchmark sense from the House of Representatives of where we are, and then to immediately begin to build on that. And so what we're really talking about here is the language, and as Tammy Baldwin said, you can't tell me that if and when I make the decision to vote for this bill for those reasons, that HRC or the task force or anybody else would characterize that vote as something negative.
Well, the other question is, and that concerns me, is the dropping of gender expression, which has always been part of, you know, sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression. Mm-hmm. And I've had to debate gender expression and explain it to many candidates. And basically, that's when I don't fit a stereotype, whether masculine or feminine, gender expression, that gives whoever... And if this bill were to pass, option to say, well, you don't fit my, your gender expression does not fit my stereotype of a male, you're fired.
Well, there obviously are a number of things that are of concern about this legislation to the community. I mean, what we have been able to do is get this markup pushed back. Everyone in the community is working on different aspects of this, from getting the language changed to getting the strategy changed for dropping the legislation to completely pulling the bill. And as I said, we've been given the opportunity to pull this back and to do this work. And there are a number of points of view. And as I said, this has somehow become a moral debate instead of a tactical debate. I think it's very much seen on the Hill as a tactical debate, and it may very well be. I mean, you know, we have no idea what the outcome is going to be. We have some.
Let me ask you this. So I think everyone agrees that we all appreciate the hard work that HRC has done and continues to do, and I think part of the confusion and the hurt that comes out of this is I don't think that HRC handled this particularly well. Do you feel like HRC has handled this well? And if they have, can you explain to me how it has gone kind of so far off the rails? And if you haven't handled it well, can you explain to me how maybe you could handle it better next time?
I think that if we could have done one thing differently, and it is... It is very easy for me 10 days later to sit back and tell you probably how I would have done many things differently, but I think we all can do that in our lives about most things that we do, so I'll just sort of, I would identify probably the one thing that we might have done differently immediately when this began to become a problem, and it would have been to alert the community in a more extensive way and be a lot more clear with the community about the process we were going to have to go through to get to a point where we would publicly say we couldn't support the bill.
Yeah.
Because I think that what you end now, you know, people have said it, you know, days and days and days went by, and I know it sometimes seems like a lifetime. I think it was 5 days of which included a weekend where we were, you know, on the Hill, working furiously, try to turn this around before we came out with a statement. And I think, again, what we should have done at the very beginning, probably the day before any of the other groups came out with a statement, instead of 4 or 5 days after, was to have said to the community in a very clear and as loud as we possibly could sort of way, you know, here's what's happening. Here's who HRC is in this. Here's what we're going to go to the Hill and do. And so that the community would not have, I completely understand the community, I think for a number of days was saying, you know, where's HRC?
Well, that was the biggest question on all the blogs, all the emails was,
yeah,
where is HRC? HRC, for, as far as the GLBT community is concerned, you know, HRC is the 500-pound gorilla. When we have a fight,
yeah,
they're the people we call on, but it appeared that HRC was absent from the fight. Even though you may have been behind the scenes,
mm-hmm,
the people who... count on HRC and are represented in Congress by HRC felt like they had been abandoned. And that was the biggest thing. Even if HRC had come out and simply said, we reaffirm, which is what the board did, reaffirm our stance concerning an inclusive bill, if you'd have done that in the first 48 hours in response, even without other comment, it would have eased a lot of people's concern.
Yes, I completely agree with you.
And I would also say, just adding, and I think you hit on this, more of an educational piece to the community about, you know, let's not panic. This is how sometimes progress is made, mm-hmm. and it may feel like you're getting left behind now, and, you know, you have to honor people's feelings about, really, you know, I mean, the transgenders are left out of this version of the bill, and that's very scary. But, you know, at times you have to take short-term gains to try to make long-term gains.
And I think that the only thing that we can do more moving forward and really learning, I mean, this is pretty weighty business we're all in here, and on any given day, you know, I'm sure you feel the same way. It's a real roller coaster ride, and so you try to learn from these experiences moving forward, and we are going to do everything we can to try and change the outcome of this and try and continue to make this an inclusive bill. But if for some reason a non-inclusive bill is voted on in the next few weeks, I think that the best thing that we can do is to be right out front and take a leadership role in saying, okay, Congressman Frank has committed to hearings on gender identity and a massive education campaign so that in a year or so we can be passing an inclusive bill. And I think, you know, what you need to hear from HRC is, you know, as the leaders in this work, here's our campaign, here's our plan, here's our budget, here is the partnership with the Hill that we worked so hard to maintain through this. And then, you know, judge us by our actions going forward.
Do you think there's a real fear, and I'm speaking from the transgender community's viewpoint, a real fear has been, and I know it's a gut-level fear, that if the gays and lesbians get theirs, the transgenders are going to be left behind. That's the fear. The community, it runs rampant and deep in the community, the transgender community.
Look, you know, I don't think it's unique to the transgender community that there's a real fear that politicians aren't going to do what they say they're going to do.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't think that's unique to the transgender community. I think that there's every reason for the transgender community, the gay community, the environmental community, the choice community, every other community out there to be concerned about what elected officials say that they're going to do and what they actually do. So I think it's an absolute, absolutely, it's a real fear, But I think that there's a difference between, I would hope that the transgender community would see the difference between challenges that we have with Congress and challenges that we have with their gay and lesbian brothers and sisters. And I would also say that I think what we've done a good job this week, even within the GLBT community, is showing them that the challenges that we have here and the problems that we have here are not so much with Nancy Pelosi and Barney Frank, but with the 61 members of Congress who support ENDA but do not support the trans-inclusive aspect of ENDA.
Understood.
Those are our targets.
Right, and understood that. Now, one quick question, because we'll have to wrap up, but I would like to get your opinion on, well, okay, we're talking about the House here and all the votes, but there isn't a companion bill of any kind in the Senate. Edward Kennedy has sort of set on it.
No, Senator Kennedy, an inclusive bill was introduced in the Senate this week.
Oh, this week? Okay, I missed that announcement. Okay,
well, you know,
but
there's a lot of other stuff going on.
Well, but you know, prior to that, when all of the furor was going on with Barney Frank introducing the substitute bill, there was no bill sitting in the Senate anyway. And from the transgender perspective, again, even Barney Frank hasn't always been friendly to the transgender community, and neither has Teddy Kennedy. Is that still the way they are? You know the inside track on that, so tell me.
Well, Senator Kennedy and Senator Susan Collins from Maine introduced a trans-inclusive bill just this week. I don't know in what ways Senator Kennedy has not been friendly to the transgender community or Congressman Frank. I mean, I was talking to someone earlier today who was complaining about the fact that they hadn't gotten anything done for them in the last 13 years, and I said, The reason that they hadn't been able to get anything done for any community in the last 13 years is because they'd been in the minority, not because they didn't intend to do something.
We noticed. Everybody noticed that.
Someone didn't notice it earlier today.
One last question before we have to close.
One last thing real quick, since I have a lot of trans friends, and I think a lot of them are feeling really kind of hurt and betrayed right now, and I think it would really help if you could kind of give just a quick elevator pitch about what HRC can say and what we can say on behalf of HRC to our T friends to make them feel a little less hurt in this whole process.
That every single decision we've made, every single thing we've done, every conversation we've had on the Hill has always been with an eye towards getting to an inclusive bill in the most expeditious way. And sometimes in the, I have had people say, and here's where I'm really struck, and here's where I feel a responsibility to do the thing that I think is going to be in the service of the community. Someone says, if I believe that we can get an inclusive bill sort of laid down, and again, this is not our, this is not what we would prefer, but if this is happening, and if a non-inclusive bill is gonna, come out of the House, and there's a philosophy that it's an education tool that we're gonna immediately move to build on, and that in 2 years or 3 years, we can have an inclusive bill, if it's that choice, or if it's pull the bill, walk away from the debate, let the elections go by, get a lot more new friends there, a year and a half or so, start this process again, and maybe it's going to be 5 or 6 years before we can do it all at once. I'm going to take the option that I think gets us to an inclusive bill fastest.
Thank you, Joe. I just wanted to let you know. I wanted to thank you for that, and thank you for being part of the show tonight. I would like to invite you back in a couple of weeks if you've got the time. Tell us what's happened. I'd like an update.
Sure.
Do you mind that?
I'd be happy to come back.
Okay. How can they contact you or HRC? Let's give you a plug there.
www.hrc.org.
Okay. Joe Salmanese, president of the Human Rights Campaign, thank you very much. This is
Thanks
Jennifer.
Thanks so much for having me on. I look forward to coming back.
Thank you. This is All Jennifer right. Renee, and this is Queer Voices.
It sure is. I think he's executive director.
No, he's president.
Oh, they changed it. They call it
president?
Well,
that's the way he signs his letters.
Really?
Yes.
Mm. El Presidente.
Well, that's different. They didn't used to have it that way. Okay, well, this is Deborah Bell. Thanks for being with us tonight, Jeff.
Thanks,
you
Deb.
Always have such wonderful comments. I just love the way you phrase things. That was a good interview. Well, we want to thank all the folks that were on the show tonight. The folks from the Montrose Counseling Center talking about the Coming Out Support Group. Caitlin McIntyre with her 7 Straight Nights for Equal Rights event, which is on October 11th over at the Montrose Counseling Center. J.D. talking with Charmin Petrie about the Houston Women's Music Festival, which is on October 20th at Jones Plaza. And certainly Jeff Reed, our political beat reporter, with Jennifer Renee interviewing Joe Salmanese of the Human Rights Campaign. Boy, it was a packed show. Now, we do want to remind people that there is more than one way to raise awareness about breast cancer. Attend Sing for the Cure, benefiting the Houston chapter of the Susan G. Komen Foundation, October 23rd at Jones Hall. The show is a unique musical experience of humanity's journey through breast cancer, featuring chorus, orchestra, and narration. For more information, visit www.BayouCityPerformingArts.org or phone 713-521-SING.
That's right. Queer Voices is here for everybody in the community. We'll listen more often, and there's more to hear.
Next week, the GLBT Behavioral Health and Wellness Coalition is hosting a town hall meeting, and they're going to talk to us about that. Go Girls Music founder Madeline Sklar will be coming on to talk about their event on November 3rd at the Glass Concert Cafe that will benefit Friends for Life, a no-kill shelter. And we have people talking about the movie premiere of Theft, a fundraiser for Pride Houston. And then J.D. has an intriguing thing called Bears on the Run.
Oh, yes, that's cool. I was talking to him earlier. It's going to be good.
Okay,
you got to listen.
Next Monday night, Thank you. This is Deborah Bell.
And Jennifer Renee.
And Jeffrey.
And?
Well, Glenn.
And I'm Glenn Holt.
Yeah, there you are. This is Queer Voices. Good night.
You have been listening to Queer Voices. Heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Starting October 22nd, KPFT will kick off its fall pledge drive, and we need your help to make it a success. So please put your spare time to use by volunteering. Our phone volunteer trainings are Wednesday, October 10th at 6 p.m. and again on Sunday, October 14th at 11 a.m. Sessions will be here at the KPFT studios, 419 Lovett Boulevard. You'll meet KPFT listeners just like you and help this community radio station. Your efforts make a difference and can make this a fun, fast, and successful drive. Again, those phone volunteer training dates are Wednesday, October 10th at 6 p.m. and Sunday, October 14th at 11 a.m. They'll be here at the studios of KPFT 41.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.